DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty as ever in the world of science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, Europe in a bid to develop science and technology infrastructure in Africa.
We need a lot of training, we need technicians, and the question is, do we have what it takes to actually develop the necessary human capacities that will support the project? Most probably not.
Also on the program, it's a taxi app's arms race, taking the world by storm.
We've now got probably two in every three cab drivers on Halo. You know, we specify it's a taxi app for taxi drivers, which passengers will use as a service.
And you wouldn't quite think that Australia, one of the sunniest countries in the world, would be suffering from soaring rates of vitamin D deficiency, would you?
Okay, that's exactly what I thought when I came here from the dark satanic mills of Northern Europe, UK, to this wonderful, bright, sunny country. And I am completely wrong.
Well, don't be wrong. Stay with us right here for Spectrum. First, it's big, it's bold, and it's very expensive. But then a project which set out to explain the origins of the universe was never going to be cheap, was it? The Square Kilometre Array, known also by its acronym of SKA, will be the world's largest radio telescope with thousands of receptors scattered across southern Africa and Australia. Not surprisingly, the SKA is a big hit in South Africa, where the scientific community is hoping it will be able to build up its infrastructure and know-how as the SKA is rolled out over the next 10 years. The trouble is that big money can bring with it big headaches, particularly when Europe's international aid objectives become part of the equation. From Brussels, James Paniki delves into the politics of scientific infrastructure in developing countries.
In a remote and inhospitable desert, something incredible is being planned. Something that will enable us to explore the universe, its past, and its ultimate fate.
Not bad for a mission statement, making sense of the Big Bang, quantifying the impact of dark energy on the expansion of the universe, and getting a sense of how the first galaxies formed. All that for a price tag of 1.5 billion euros. The SKA already has the backing of 10 governments, including those of Sweden, Germany and the Netherlands. And not surprisingly, it can rely on the full support of South Africa, which has secured 70% of the project.
A masterpiece of scientific engineering that will be the world's largest, most powerful radio telescope. The Square Kilometre Array.
So much for the big picture. However, the reality of research infrastructure partnerships between European investors and developing economies in Africa is often much less glamorous. In fact, it usually sounds a lot more like this.
One other thing is the integrated approach, because instead of just different disciplines focusing...
We're in a Brussels hotel conference room. PowerPoint presentations are overloaded with scientific jargon, pie charts and graphs. It's the unglamorous starting point of arrangements between European agencies on the one hand and African research institutions and governments on the other. The conference has been organised by a body called Promoting Africa EU Research Infrastructure Partnerships. And African participants are keen to remind their European partners that securing the initial funding for research infrastructure is only part of the deal.
Sure, what's out there? Because a lot of it is undocumented.
Edith Madela-Mintlar is the director of the International Council for Science's Regional Office for Africa. She says that for the continent to get anything out of science infrastructure projects, human capacity development is the name of the game.
We need a lot of training. We need technicians. If you look at the SK project, for instance, it's going to need a hang of a lot of technicians. It's a complex project. And the question is, do we have what it takes to actually develop the necessary human capacities that will support the project? Most probably not.
But human capacity, the technicians and scientists who can work on such projects, can only develop when the country's universities and research institutes are connected to the world. That's why e-infrastructure is the buzzword at this conference. Dr. Madela Mintla again.
Most places in Africa don't interact because of the difficulties in accessibility or in interacting between the countries, mainly because some countries don't have good internet connectivity. Access to computers themselves in most countries is still quite a challenge. So if you talk e-infrastructure, that's the biggest challenge in Africa.
South Africa is seen as the African standout when it comes to investment in science. But for many speakers at this conference, the risk faced by those African countries which are able to attract foreign money for research infrastructure is that local scientific know-how is sidelined because it's not up to standard. Yet according to Daniel Adams from South Africa's Science and Technology Department, his country is ready to harness the benefits of the SKA.
The investment will translate into the benefits for the country across the board spectrum, building human capacity in the country, building research capacity, but that then translate into economic benefits, innovation in the country, which then again translate at the very high level into both economic impact, but also socioeconomic or social impact in terms of improving the quality of life of the people.
Yet the SKA is also a reminder of how complex the building of research infrastructure in developing countries can be. Funding from a range of governments and private players needs to come together. Development outcomes must be integrated into the project, and ancillary initiatives such as e-infrastructure must also come together. So a lot of stars have to align, and communication among participants is key to that. Kostas Glinos is the head of Unit for E-Infrastructure at the European Union Directorate General Connect. That's Europe's Ministry for Communications Networks, Content and Technology.
We need to increase the political awareness in Africa about the importance of building a state-of-the-art infrastructure. And we need a better coordination also between international funders, because the European Commission, through development aid, we fund a number of things, but there are many other international organizations, national European, for example, programs, private ones like Melinda and Bill Gates Foundation, like there are so many, the World Bank, so on. So we need probably a better coordination between these international programs.
All this becomes a science in its own right. How to bring research infrastructure to a continent which desperately needs it, and how to support local scientific communities once the infrastructure is in place. James Paniki for DW in Brussels.
Now, an interesting story has just come up out of the UK. And not a week after we brought you our in-depth look at the European Union's drive towards public-private partnerships through the Innovative Medicines Initiative, or IMI. Professor Dame Sally Davis, the Chief Medical Officer for England, says that urgent global action is now needed to fight antibiotic or antimicrobial resistance. And she cited the IMI in Brussels as an example of what we need to be doing to encourage the pharmaceutical industry to invest in new drugs. No new class of antibiotics has come onto the market since the mid-1980s, and Professor Davies says that if we don't start work on new antibiotics within the next few years, we'll be thrown back to medical standards of about the early 1900s. Well, we knew that, sort of. But what is interesting is Davies' comments on domestic British radio this Monday, in which she stressed the point that the international pharmaceutical industry, so not just that in the UK, it needs more of a cash incentive to develop the new drugs. Speaking on Radio 4's Today programme, Sally Davies compared antibiotics to drugs for things like high blood pressure. Now, she said that while you generally take antibiotics for a week or 2 weeks, if you take a drug for high blood pressure and you respond well to it, you'll likely stay on it for life. And therein lies the incentive for pharmaceutical companies. They'd rather we kept on taking drugs to mitigate a condition rather than take antibiotics that actually cure us within a week or two. Well, that's how you could interpret what she said. Davis, that was England's chief medical officer, also says we're responsible for having set up the industry to work like that. Well, if you've got an opinion on that, why not let us know? We're at DW_SciTech on Twitter, and of course do use the hashtag DWSpectrum. Ready to blast. you ever come out of a pub or restaurant and realised that you've got no way of getting home? Like the last train left half an hour ago, you've no idea where the bus stop is and you haven't got the number for a taxi. Or you need to rush across town for a meeting, but end up waiting helplessly as three taxis drive by full of passengers. Well, pretty soon, all of that could be a thing of the past as taxi apps are taking over. The last couple of years have seen the launch of several smartphone applications to book cabs, but the battle for top spot is now turning global this year, as Robin Powell reports from London.
London isn't short of taxis. There are 22,000 licensed taxis here, the capital's iconic black cabs, taking some 300,000 passengers every day. Private minicabs transport a similar number on a daily basis. The problem is, there isn't always one coming down the street when you need it. A number of smartphone apps have appeared in order to solve this problem. Currently, the most successful one here is called Halo. Launched in November 2011 by three taxi drivers and three internet entrepreneurs, Halo has 200,000 registered users. But perhaps more importantly, the people behind Halo started by recruiting black cab drivers. As one of the co-founders, Russell Hall, told me.
If you're taking taxis in London yourself, you know that the taxi driver you actually have is probably a quite knowledgeable person. So to introduce something to them that you're trying to convince them this is a game changer for their shift is quite a it's quite a task. Once drivers get it, it's like, as I said, you know, we've now got probably two in every three cab drivers on Halo. You know, we specify it is it's a taxi app for taxi drivers, which passengers will use as a service.
So it seems that the drivers are on board, but what about the punters? What's in it for them? Well, I've got the app open on my smartphone here now. It's picked up my location on a side street off a main thoroughfare in central London. It shouldn't take long, so pick me up here, one click. It says details about our service, pay with cards, continue, confirm I'll pay by card account, click on that, and it's now contacting the driver. Now it's telling me my driver is Stephen C, giving me the vehicle registration and says he's arriving in just 1 minute. Now I've seen a couple of taxis go by on the street just up ahead. I probably could have got those, but 1 minute certainly seems to be pretty quick. Let's see if he arrives. There's one coming around the corner and we see that here he is and he's just arrived. That's the registration mark.
Can you take me down to Regent Street?
Sure, of course, yeah.
Stephen and any driver that uses Halo has to hand over 10% of each fare booked using the app, but he says it's worth it.
I think possibly these apps are the best thing that happened to the black cab trade for quite a while. The amount of extra work it's generated.
You said there was a group of people that probably won't ever use it.
You always get the drivers who are set in their ways, don't you? Who won't change, who won't embrace technology.
With nearly €60 million of venture capital in its pocket, Halo has expanded operations to six other cities in Europe and the US, with imminent launches planned in New York and Tokyo. But it's far from the only taxi app around. Operational in 15 cities, including Moscow and Tel Aviv, the Get Taxi app has €20 million in funding. Another one called Uber, more focused on bigger or luxury cars, has done trials in the huge New York market, where regulators have only just approved app bookings. The prize for ambition, however, must go to Denmark-based Clicker Taxi. In February, Clicker Taxi announced a global launch, claiming that you can use the app to find a taxi in 40 countries. Its CEO, Søren Halskov Nissen, explains the reasoning behind the rapid expansion.
It will be hard to communicate to the user that this is actually going to happen if it's something you stretch over 3 years. We've had a goal that for every major country in the Western world that we've mapped out and stitched together with cab companies, that any city with more than 50,000 citizens has to be covered.
Halo's Russell Hall says he isn't in such a rush.
We deliver quality rather than quantity. So if we say we're going to launch in a city, we do it with professionalism. You know, if you want to rush things out, then obviously you're not going to get the tailor-made product which you want to deliver.
Whether aiming for quality or quantity, it's unlikely any one taxi app will dominate in the future. Rather like restaurant booking websites now, there will probably be a number to choose from. But Cambridge-based app developer Matt Sims believes that taxi app developers better watch out for when the big guns of the online world take notice.
I'd be surprised if Google didn't try to do something. Most likely they'd do something on their own, which
I think would probably grow quite quickly, because obviously the amount of resources they have, they can probably do it better than anybody else.
For the consumer, it doesn't really matter which apps become the most successful. They all do similar things in a pretty similar way, and they're all simple to use. Which means that this ride back home may be the last time I hold my hand out on the street and call, taxi! Robin Powell for DW, London.
And if you're out and about right now and need a cab, you'll be happy to know that there are plenty of other taxi apps around, including one called MyTaxi, which was started by a German firm, and a San Francisco-based Uber, which has funding from Amazon and Goldman Sachs.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
For the visually impaired, a smartphone with a touchscreen has for a long time been like a book without Braille. But in recent years, speech recognition technology has started to make mobile devices more accessible. Smartphones are becoming everyday devices for the visually impaired, slowly. But there aren't many apps which are there specifically to help the blind and the visually impaired. Still, people are tinkering around with software that can make daily life for the blind somewhat easier with the help of smartphones, thanks to a simple technology. Our reporter Maximilian Grosser met inventor Erich Turner and got to see how his software Mind Tags is making everyday things more accessible to the visually impaired. Jesse Wingard has his report.
With just 1% of his vision remaining, Erich Turner is legally blind. So you wouldn't expect to see him standing in front of an information board with lots of words and images. But here he is. Though the words and images on the board are of little use to someone who is visually impaired, Erich Turner can still get the information. That's because a small chip, known as a transponder, which is built into the information board, is turning the words and images on it into sound.
To get the information, I take the phone and unlock it.
Ich entriegel es.
Startseite.
Homepage.
Ich krieg das akustische Feedback.
My phone tells me what's happening. I look for the transponder on the information board.
Bei weiterer Berührung.
When I move my phone over the transponder, it gives me the information contained on the chip. In this case, it's an audio file about the founding of the Federal Republic of Germany in 1949. I don't even have to touch the display once.
With simple wireless technology, Erich Turner's smartphone turns into a storyteller in the museum. Near-field communication, or NFC, is the name given to the sensor technology, originally designed for cashless payments using a smartphone.
By the cash payments,
if I use the phone to pay for something, then it uses a sensor to deduct the amount. For example, a can of cola for 50 cents or a euro.
50 cent, meinetwegen, oder 1 Euro führt.
The NFC technology is freely available, even for programmers, but they have completely different ideas about what to use it for.
Es geht also eine schnelle Antwort, und das kann
NFC chips are able to respond to requests very quickly. The sensor receives a signal and the NFC transponder sends information back to the phone. As someone who is visually impaired, that helps me get information.
Individuell gestartet sind, sei mal dahingestellt.
The transponder works like a barcode on a packet of noodles. Like a checkout scanner at a supermarket reads the black bars and gets information on the price and product, the phone is able to scan the chips for information. If it recognises a chip, it provides the user with the information saved on the NFC transponder, and it can be used for just about anything.
Aspirin, dosage, 3 times daily. Expiration, March 2015.
Transponders can even be put on packaging for medication. They can be hidden in smart cards, stickers, or small buttons. They can even be used as domestic helpers, telling consumers about a particular item in their home.
Jeans, blue, stonewashed.
The NFC chips are made audible by Mind Tags, software Erich Turner created. But for Torsten Brower from Friends of the Blind, Mind Tags is a lot more.
Ich kann überall Informationen.
I can get information everywhere for next to nothing. Imagine the supermarket has a chip outside with all the special offers on it, so the customer can decide whether to go in and if the offers are worthwhile. But you can also get information for every product. It sounds so corny when you can see, but for visually impaired people, it's a useful thing.
Aber für blinde Menschen ist das schon eine hilfreiche Sache.
Torsten Brauer is also thinking about the benefits of putting small electronic stickers on light poles. Visually impaired people could scan them to get street names when crossing a road or use them as a guide, and it would mean they could also navigate their own environments more independently. Berlin social scientist Regina Franken-Wendelsdorf, who is involved in the museum project testing mind tags, says it has an advantage over traditional museum audio guides.
Der Mehrwert besteht in dem Mitnehmen. Ein audio guide.
The added value is that you can take it away with you. At the end of a visit to a museum, you have to give an audio guide back. What I've saved to my phone, I'm able to take home with me. I can listen to it again at home or reread it.
Ein Mehrwert, den ich durch einen Audioguide so nicht habe.
Not a bad idea, especially for people who can't spend a lot of time at the museum.
Jesse Wingard with that report there by Maximilian Grosser. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfi Karabani, on DW Online. We're at dw.de/spectrum, and you can, of course, follow us at dw_SciTech. You might even like to let us know whether you think cardinals attending the conclave to appoint a new pope at the Vatican should be able to, or allowed to, tweet even. In the name of transparency, of course. It was, after all, Pope Benedict who has just resigned, who opened up a papal Twitter account and encouraged tech-savvy cardinals to get on the network too. But a system's been installed now to scramble any mobile communication with the outside world, so there's to be no Twitter, no Facebook and no conclave apps. But why? I don't know. Now, far away from the Vatican, Australia, you may know, is one of the sunniest countries in the world, so when it comes to things like vitamin D, which is produced by sun exposure, you would think that Australians would also have some of the highest levels in the world. Well, you'd be wrong. Paradoxically, the largest vitamin D study ever done in the country recently found that vitamin D deficiency in Australia is soaring. Kate Hairsine reports from the West Australian capital of Perth.
Hi, good morning. I'm a journalist and I have an appointment with Richard Prince.
I'm at the St Charles Gardner Hospital in Perth, and I'm here to meet Dr. Richard Prince. He's an endocrinologist. That means he's a doctor who specialises in the treatment of the body's hormonal system. But Dr. Prince wears many hats. He's also a renowned medical researcher.
Vitamin D and bone disease has been one of my principal areas of interest for 30 years.
Vitamin D has been called the sunshine vitamin because the body produces it when the skin is exposed to ultraviolet radiation found in sunlight. And the link between vitamin D and bone disease is that vitamin D causes your body to absorb more calcium, the mineral the bones are built of. Vitamin D was first discovered back in the beginning of the 20th century, Dr. Prince explains.
It was found to play a major role in the development of a condition that was really common in those days called rickets, in which your skeleton is not properly calcified and then your bones bend and you can't have babies because your pelvis is too small and you're stunted. And it caused a huge amount of trouble in Europe at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, basically because they didn't get enough sunlight.
I can imagine, though, there's not much of this problem, though, in Australia, one of the sunniest countries in the world. You would never see vitamin D deficiency, would you?
Okay, that's exactly what I thought when I came here from the dark satanic mills of Northern Europe, UK, to this wonderful, bright, sunny country. And I am completely wrong. There is as much vitamin D deficiency here in the 21st century as there is in anywhere other country.
An estimated 30% of Australians are vitamin D deficient. This figure rises in winter when, for example, around 35% of men and nearly 60% of women living in the south of Australia don't have high enough levels of the vitamin.
And the reason is that we have changed our lifestyle. We have nice clothes, we have beautiful buildings, and we have glass. And the sort of UV you need to make vitamin D doesn't get through glass. And we then sit in front of computers all day long. So the basic facts are that we don't actually get much sun exposure.
For Dr. Prince, the main concern is elderly people. 6 out of 10 old people in Australia have low levels of vitamin D.
Recently, we found that as part of this vitamin D deficiency, especially in old people, the muscles don't work very well and you're more likely to fall over. So there's a double reason why our elderly population should have good vitamin D and good calcium. One, to strengthen their bones, and two, to strengthen their muscles.
So the easiest solution to the problem of vitamin D deficiency, you'd think, would be to tell people in Australia to go outside more often. Wrong again.
I'm running along a Perth beach at sunset with 43-year-old amateur triathlete Fiona Revens.
I usually run about 3 or 4 times a week, and I ride about 3 or 4 times a week, swim both in the pool and in the beach. I put me outside for about 90 minutes to 2 hours every day.
Despite being outside so much, 3 years ago, Fiona was diagnosed with vitamin D deficiency.
Because I've got red hair and freckles and fair skin, I'm at high risk of skin cancer. So I usually cover up, lots of sunscreen, long sleeves, hats, a whole lot.
Australia has the highest levels of skin cancer in the world. And for several decades, the Australian Cancer Council has been bombarding Australians with public health messages, like this one to cover up.
Slip on a shirt, slop on sunscreen and slap on a hat. Slip, slop.
The Cancer Council argues that other lifestyle factors are mainly responsible for the prevalence of vitamin D deficiency in the country. However, it does admit that for many light-skinned Australians, who are more at risk of skin cancer than olive or dark-skinned people, finding a balance between getting enough vitamin D and not getting skin cancer is extremely difficult. Terry Slavin from the Cancer Council, WA.
There's a known problem, there's a known cause. The known problem is skin cancer rates, highest in the world. The known cause is high levels of UV radiation. So there's a known prevention, reducing UV radiation exposure. The trick is to reduce that UV radiation exposure while minimising any possible adverse effects associated with making in any way worse, if it exists, major problems when it comes to vitamin D deficiency.
For Dr. Richard Prince and many other experts, there is an easy answer. Vitamin D supplements in foods such as milk or cereal. That way, the combination of the vitamin D and the extra calcium in the milk could help all Australians to have healthier bones. For DW, this is Kate Hairsine eating her cereal in Perth.
Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. And you can listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfikar Abani. Our studio tech was Thomas Schmidt. Hope you can make it next week. Thanks for listening and bye for now.